Hey everyone, I'm Janet B. I've recovered from compulsive eating and bulimia. So today we are going to be talking about step three and how it works. But before we do, I just want to back up a little bit. So we all know there's such things like the law of gravity, right? If I drop something, it's going to fall. How come airplanes don't fall out of the sky, right? Interesting question. Because there's a higher law, there's a law of aerodynamics, and that supersedes the law of gravity. So basically, me on my own, subject to the laws of earthbound gravity, could not stop binging. I needed something higher to remove. I needed to just get into a different place. And in fact, what we talk about tonight, it talks about, we walk through an arch or a keystone. We walk through an arch to a new freedom. And it reminds me of like the Wizard of Oz. We start out in black and white and we walk through this arch and we're in color. We start out binging and miserable, unable to stop. And then we end up free from the obsession. And just like, with when we drop something, we know there's a law of gravity. Unless, as we saw from the Wright brothers, they figured out how to transcend that. Getting abstinent and staying abstinent. Is it when we use words like miracle and God does for us what we couldn't do for ourselves? But is it just like willy-nilly? Does God just like roll the dice and say, okay, your name's on the dice, you're going to recover today? Or, oh, eeny, meeny, miny, mo. Mo's going to recover today. Is it like that? Because if it is, like, why would we bother like studying this book or doing certain things? But this program tells us it's not like that. And we finished up with this on page 57 last week. And they talk about the minister's son who was restored. And they say, what is this but a miracle of healing? Yet its elements are simple. Elements like, okay, here are the rules. One, circumstances made him willing to believe. Then two, he humbly offered himself to his maker. Then he knew. Then he could fly. So I want to just back up real quickly onto circumstances making him willing to believe. What are those circumstances? And that's knowing that we're powerless. Again, no one's going to go for chemo unless they believe they have terminal cancer. And no one is going to work these steps because it gets hard unless we know that we've got like terminal compulsive eating. So what exactly does it mean to be a compulsive eater? And the analogy I use is the story of a broken bridge. So I know a lot of you have heard it before, but just like Melissa brings out her before pictures when there's a bunch of newcomers, because it's helpful to tell a story, I bring out my broken bridge story. So if you've heard it before and don't want to hear it again, you can go get a cup of coffee for about 2.5 minutes. But I think it's really important because a lot of times we sit there and, if there's anyone here who's like me and was told you don't have a desire to stop, you must not want it badly enough. Or, you're here. So if you're not stopping, you either don't want it badly enough or you don't understand it or you don't know enough about what to eat or what not to eat. It's something about knowledge and desire. But our book tells us no, that when we're hopeless, it says that desire means nothing because on page 24, we're told we're unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We're without defense against the first drink. Okay, so if you're like me, you would read that and say, oh, it's a lot of words there, memory, suffering, defense. How does that all fit? So normally, our defense against doing something dangerous is our memory, right? Let's say I'm about to touch a hot stove. In my memory are stored all these data points telling me touching a hot stove is dangerous. So if I'm about to touch a hot stove, my memory grabs the data points, generates a little thought that runs across the bridge to my conscious mind to say, stop, danger, hot stoves will burn you. And I don't touch the stove. Or as people who know me know, I have a terrible allergy to cats. I'm liable to like have an asthma attack. So stored in my memory are a bunch of data points of cat-induced asthma attacks. So when my dear sponsee, Rebecca, invites me over for Thanksgiving, and I know she's got two cats in my, and I want to go, but stored in my memory are all these data points of cat-induced asthma attacks. So before I can say yes, my memory grabs those data points, sends a little cross across thought, across the bridge to my conscious mind to say, stop, danger, cats will give you asthma attacks. My memory keeps me from danger. And I don't go to Rebecca's house, sadly. But now let's talk about food. So for example, I used to binge on the certain brand of cookies in college. I mean, I binge on a lot, but this was my favorite. It would come in a box of 20. And I would tell myself, I'm going to just have one or two, but I would end up eating the whole box of 20 at least. So in my memory, all these data points, Janet, you say you're going to have one or two and you're going to end up eating the whole box. So there I go, about to go to the Duane Reade, which was my crack den, to buy my cookies, to just have one or two. And my memory generates, you know, goes, gets the data that says, you say you're going to have just one or two, you're going to eat the whole box. You're going to hate yourself. You're going to gain weight. Don't do it. Generates a little thought to run across the bridge to my conscious mind. Except unlike with hot stoves and cats, the thought can't get across because the bridge is broken. My memory fails to hold me in check, and I have no defense against the first compulsive bite because there's a broken bridge. How does a bridge get broken? I'll just save you all $10,000 in therapy. We don't know. That's what they tell us in the book. It says, we don't know. The reason we usually want to find out is so that we know who to blame, usually our parents, but they just say, we don't know. It's like, it's just, but again, if we have cancer, we don't sit there and go to therapy to say, how did I get this cancer? Did the dentist give me too many x-rays when I was a kid? We just go for the treatment. So those are the circumstances that make us willing to believe. Remember, this is very logical. And then we need a willingness to believe. So when we're desperate, we'll do it, right? Like right now, I have no idea if chemotherapy helps. But if I had cancer, I would be willing to look at chemo or whatever else the experts tell me will help. And then he humbly offered himself to his maker, and he knew. So for the past 2 weeks, we talked about getting a relationship with trust of God, because obviously we're not going to turn our will and our lives over to an entity that we don't trust. That would just be silly. So we worked on what we can do so that we can trust God. We clear away our spiritual cataracts, and we look at the prejudices that we have, our preconceived notions, such as, a nun hit me with a ruler when I was in parochial school. Therefore, you know, God doesn't exist. Ignoring the fact that the same religion that produced the ruler hitting nun produced a Mother Teresa. You know, we're very quick to look at all these things that God does wrong and not at all the things he does right. So we worked through that the past couple of weeks. And so now here we find ourselves at the point where we're, you know, okay, I can believe that there is a God, and not just that a God exists, but that this God cares enough about me to restore me to sanity. So that's where we left off. And we're going to pick up at the top of page 58, how it works. Because remember, it's almost like a formula. It works. So Susan, could you read the first paragraph, please?
Yes. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those too who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest.
Thank you. So it says that if we follow their path, we're going to get better. So I always challenge people, like, everything you hear at meetings may not be true. I mean, depending on the meetings you go to. So if you're not sure, check the information you hear out in this book. And I would say the same thing to my sponsees. Like, if I say anything that goes against this book, let me know and we'll both learn something. But if we follow this path, we get their results, which is a spiritual experience, a rewired heart. And they tell us the first thing that's going to block us. It's like, okay, so you may know you're a compulsive eater. You may believe that God can restore you to sanity. But the first thing that's going to block you from allowing God to restore you to sanity is dishonesty. They basically say, if you're not honest, you could try and do everything else right. You could write a food plan. You can go to meetings. You can call a sponsor. You could do inventories. If you're not honest, it's like you took a big black magic marker and wrote the words, keep out God, right across your heart. God absolutely won't exist with dishonesty. So that's the first thing they tell us, get honest. And then they say, okay, our stories tell us what we used to be like, what happened and what we're like now. What we used to be like, living on self-will. What happened, finding God. And what we are like now, live in the miracle. And then they tell us the requirement for working these steps, right? Because if you're going to look for a sponsor, you want to make sure that your sponsor has worked these steps, right? And can guide you through it. But a sponsor should check and make sure that the sponsee meets the requirements. And there's two requirements to be sponsorable. If you've decided, so again, this is a decision. It's not like a condition we find ourselves in, like being blue-eyed. That's a condition I find myself in. But these are decisions, two decisions a potential sponsee has to make. You want what we have. And what do we have? Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. Not diet with support, a spiritual change as a result of these steps. And if you've decided, you're willing to go to any lengths to get it, which means you're going to put your will in action. Willingness doesn't mean desire, right? All of us are moms, know that at 3 a.m. when the baby cries, and we're really tired, we get up, not because we have this great desire to get up and change a diaper or feed or whatever, but we're willing. We've made a decision that that's what we're going to do for our babies. So it says, if you want what we have and you're willing to go to any lengths to get it, then and only then are you ready to take certain steps. And it tells us that you're going to balk, which means you don't want to. It doesn't matter. You know, I had a sponsee tell me today, like, oh, you know, I get angst whenever I, you know, do this kind of work. And it's like, yeah, okay, now let's move on and do the work. It doesn't matter whether we want to or not. And so they just say, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough to do it. And then it tells us what we deal with. Remember that we deal with alcohol or food, cunning, baffling, powerful. That's a really weird sentence, right? Like if I were to tell you my shoe was cunning, baffling, and powerful, you would say that makes no sense. A shoe is a common noun and you're giving it traits like a proper noun, like a person. Cunning. I looked up the definition. Having skill in achieving a goal by cunning. Oh, that's not really good using a word to define a word. But in any case, Just kind of being like kind of slimy, a way to kind of manipulate and get our goal, like smart in a not very nice way. Inanimate objects aren't like that. Even if we think of food, right? A piece of cake isn't cunning. And then baffling, like confusing, powerful. I think what they mean is there's a force behind all this. A force behind the alcohol or the food. And it's not a very nice force, but it's a smart force and it's a powerful force. And that's why the next line is, without help, it is too much for us. I can't fight it. But there is one, and again, one with a capital letter, who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. So they're saying that's the solution. And they tell us half measures avail us nothing. Of course, we all know that, right? If we get a 50% on a test, we get a big fat F. We stood at the turning point. We asked God's protection and care with complete abandon. Look at that beautiful imagery here. And, I sometimes think of this kind of protection and care, back in like high school or maybe even middle school, we learned about the kings and they had serfs working the land. And then when the invading armies would come to attack, the kings would, have someone draw up the drawbridge over the moats. Remember all this, guys, back from like eighth grade or something? And if you're on the king's land, you're protected. You're protected. The invading army can't touch you. I get in trouble when I wander off the king's land, not because the king doesn't care about me, but I've taken myself away from his protection and care. So they're saying right now, we're going to the king and we're saying, I need to be protected and cared for. I'm here. I'm yours. And they say, okay, that's what you want. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. Well, how come? How come these steps are necessary for me to be protected and cared for? And back in the Oxford groups, which AA was mostly derived from, it said the purpose was destruction of our egos at depth. And this fosters transformation. We have to get rid of our ego, and that's what the steps are around are designed to do. Soul surgery, like the removal of a spiritual cancer. So the first three steps is when we just see we have it and we make a decision to do it. And then steps four through nine are ways that we unblock the channel to God. We've clogged it with all the muck of our character defects and our harms to others, and we unblock the channel to God. Step 10, we unblock the channel from this day. Step 11, we fill the channel through prayer and meditation. And step 12, the channel of grace overflows to others. All that stuff about the channel is courtesy of Herb K. Then look at step 12, the beautiful promise there. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, souls are transformed. Then and only then we try to carry this message, of recovery, of transformation to other compulsive eaters and practice these principles in all our affairs. And they say, what an order, I can't go through with it, which basically means this looks really freaking hard. And they say, don't worry. Don't worry. Like, we're not saints, but we're going to keep growing. And then it tells us, lays out the ABCs of recovery, of coming to believe in God, of being to the point where we could turn our will and our lives over to Him. And I think it's like masterful the way they do it. So again, you can ask yourself if you're here or ask your sponsees, like, A, do you believe you're a compulsive eater and can't manage your own life? Well, by this point, a person will generally say yes. If not, they need to go back and do some step one work. Two, that probably no human power could have relieved our compulsive eating. Well, if I'm relying on a human power, and let's say all of you, and all of you go out and binge, or I'm somewhere where I can't reach anyone, I'm in trouble. And really, what besides locking me in a room and, you know, slipping three meals a day under the door, how can you relieve me of my compulsive eating? You can't. And even then, you might be able to stop me from binging, but you can't stop me from obsessing about food. It just, so it doesn't make sense to think another person can. Now, we give each other tons of support and guidance and love, but we can't relieve someone else's obsession. And then we get to the fun part, that God could and would if he were sought. So we start by asking someone, do you believe that God could restore other people to sanity? Forget about yourself for a minute, other people. And if they've been to a few meetings, they would look back and they would look around and say, well, yeah, God could do it for them. Great. Next. Do you believe that God could do it for you if he wanted to? That he could. He may not want to. We're not there yet. Could he if he wanted to? And it's very hard to say, well, God could for other people, but he couldn't for me. His hands are tied. So generally it's like, well, yeah, he could if he wanted to, but he may not want to. It's like, that's fine. Let's just get to where he could. Now, that he would if he were sought. And a lot of times people say he could, but he won't. And so then we go into the reasons, and I have found five reasons. I don't think there, if you've come up with more, you know, tell me, but I think it generally fits into one of these five categories. One, I don't deserve it because I've done this really bad thing. And if that's the case, we can just assure the person, well, that's great that you're just like the founders of AA. That's why they put a step nine in here to make amends, because they all did really bad things. That's not a criteria. You'll get a chance to fix it. Okay. Two, someone might say, well, he might help people with cancer because, you know, they didn't cause it, but this is my fault, right? They might take the line in the book that says selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of the illness and say, because I was so selfish and self-centered, you know, I cause this, so I have no right to go to God. And then we can say, you know, again, very lovingly, if you didn't look both ways before you crossed the street and you got hit by a bus and you had two broken legs, would you say, you know what, I'm not going to the orthopedic surgeon because it's my fault I got hit by a bus? Of course we wouldn't. So when it comes to God, though, suddenly we get all noble and say, well, I can't bother God. And to that, I say, bother God. It's fine. And then the third thing is sometimes people just have say, I'm not worthy. It's not like they say, I did this bad thing that I need to make amends for. It's just this vague feeling of shame or unworthiness. I'm not worthy. And to that, I would say, worthiness is never a requirement. Willingness is. Book never says we have to be worthy. Again, we can spend, you know, thousands of dollars to find a therapist who will sit there and try and raise our self-esteem. We don't need to have high self-esteem to work this program. In fact, our esteem gets, I don't want to say high, I want to say healthy, as a result of working this program and realizing that we're loved by God. So at this point, it's just, it doesn't matter if we feel worthy. It's just, are we willing to go to any lengths? And then four, I've tried so many times before and it hasn't worked. And then I always like hold up my cell phone and I say, I could try 100 times to take a picture by pushing this button and it doesn't work. I'm pushing, I guess, the on off button, doesn't work. But suddenly, if someone shows me, no, Janet, this is the right one. This, you know, this is the camera button. It doesn't matter that I've tried 100 times, 1,000 times before to take a picture. Now I know how to take a picture. So if I'm willing to learn a new way to use my phone, I'll be able to take pictures. And then the fifth thing is someone might say, well, I believe God could, and he would if I sought him, but I'm not sure I'm seeking him properly. And this is where a sponsor can help by saying, okay, make a list of what you think it means to seek him. And then what on the list are you not doing? Because again, sometimes it's just a vague feeling. And if someone says, oh, I think God wants me to have a quiet time with him every morning and I'm not willing to, well, then we can go back to the person isn't willing to go to any length and, you know, isn't sponsorable. But usually it's just a vague feeling of unworthiness we have. If we've gotten to this point, we're generally willing. Okay, so now we're sitting there, we say, okay, not only do I believe in God, but I believe that he can and will restore me to sanity if I seek him. So it says, great. Once you're convinced of that, you're at step three, which is we decide to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand him. Obedience and surrender, and they're different things. Surrender alone means, I would say, no matter what happens, it's the will of God. I surrender it. I surrender. Well, I mean, using that logic, I could go out and rob a bank. And then if I get arrested and spend the rest of my life in jail, it's like, I surrendered. It's God's will that I just spend my life in jail. But obedience means once I surrender, I do what I think he would have me. And of course, since he wants me to be honest, bank robbing is off the table. So they go together. I'm obedient. I do what I think God wants me to, but I surrender the results. So for instance, I try to raise my kids a certain way with certain values and manners. However they turn out, none of my business. So I don't have to get upset if they're not going to church or not choosing the major that I think they should, or, you know, whatever they're doing or not doing that I want them to. I do my part. The results are none of my business. And now we're going to get down to exactly how we do it. So Susan, can you read starting with the first requirement, but read it in the first person? Yes. Two paragraphs. And guys, whenever, if you're ever struggling, someone did this with me. She got me on the phone and did it with my name in it. And I saw I was struggling because I was drowning in self-will. So to read it with our own names in it is very, very powerful.
Did you say the two paragraphs or just the first one?
Starting the first requirement and then the one after that as well in the first person.
Got it. Thank you.
Thank you.
The first requirement is that Susan be convinced that Susan's life run on self-will can hardly be a success. On that basis, Susan is almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though her motives are good. Most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person, Susan is like an actor who wants to run the whole show. She's forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players on her list. True. If Susan's arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as Susan wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including Susan, would be pleased. Yay. Life would be wonderful. In trying to make these arrangements, Susan may sometimes be quite virtuous. She may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. On the other hand, she may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. But as with most humans, Susan is more likely to have varied traits. Keep going?
Yeah, one more.
Okay. What usually happens? The show doesn't come off very well. Susan begins to think life doesn't treat her right. She decides to exert herself more. Susan becomes, on the next occasion, still more demanding or gracious, as the case may be. Still, the play does not suit her. Admitting she may be somewhat at fault, she is sure that other people are more to blame. She becomes angry, indignant, self-pitying. What's Susan's basic trouble? Is she not really a self-seeker even when trying to be kind? Is she not a victim of the delusion that she can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if only she manages well? Is it not evident to all the rest of the players that these are things that Susan wants? And don't her actions make each of them wish to retaliate, snatching all they can out of the show? Is Susan not, even in her best moments, a producer of confusion rather than harmony?
Well, if there's anyone else here whose name is Susan, I'm sure that cut you to the heart, because when my friend read that to me with my name, by the time she was done, all the family members I thought were just horrible people, it was suddenly different. And it's like, oh, it's me. It's all me. And thank God, because I can't change any of them, but I can change me. And so what does it say? My basic trouble is, am I not a self-seeker even when I'm nice? Aren't I looking for something? And even so, that's if I'm raising my kids and taking them to church every week, because I think that's God's will, but I have the end goal in mind. It's okay to have a desire, but if I have a demand that they end up while they're in college going to church every week, I'm going to be miserable because they're not, but it's okay because I don't get my self-esteem based on the results. I get them based on my obedience to God. So we look at how we are self-seekers. And then it gives us examples. The retired businessman who complains about the sad state of the nations, the minister who sighs over the sins of the 20th century. All these people, what they are is they may be good people, except perhaps the outlaw safecracker, but what they're all doing is looking at people outside themselves. I'm a good person. If only those Democrats would behave. If only those Republicans would pass the correct laws. If only, you know, these people would do this or those people would do that, life would be fine. And I think the best answer I ever heard to this, G.K. Chesterton, who's a famous writer, and the London Times was soliciting articles for what's wrong with the world today. And he wrote in, "Dear sir, I am sincerely G.K. Chesterton." That's it. Yes, Susan, he was in London, so blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, I am. That's what's wrong. And that's all I need to look at. And then it tells us what the root of my troubles is, selfishness and self-centeredness. Interesting. On my book, I drew a little picture of a tree because in a tree, remember, you can't see the roots. They're underground. Selfishness and self-centeredness. But you could see the fruit. And what are our fruits? Resentments, fears, and harms to others. So it's interesting because resentment, they're saying, isn't primary. It's a fruit of self-centeredness. If I don't really care so much about what happens to me, my pride, my little plans and schemes, I'm not going to get angry so much. Selfishness and self-centeredness, that they say is the root of our troubles. And they say our troubles are basically of our own making. Well, again, that's great news, because if I cause them by being so self-centered and prideful, then I can resolve them with God's help. And this program will give me the tools, and we'll talk about that next week. Now it says basically of our own making. So I want to be really clear. If there's like a child who's been molested or someone who's been, you know, raped at gunpoint or, you know, other situations like that, I would never say that's a situation of your own making, okay? This program still will give us tools to heal from that. And of course, we may need outside help, which the program says we're allowed to do and encouraged to do at times. But our troubles are basically, most of our troubles are of our own making, and they arise out of our self-will run riot. And it says, we usually don't think we're self-will run riot. You know, right? I didn't sit there and say, oh yeah, I'm causing all this chaos in my family because I'm self-will run riot. I didn't see it. And it says, we need God to help us get rid of this selfishness. It's just like, if I had cancer, I couldn't make my cancer cells stop multiplying just because I really wanted them to. And I couldn't make myself be unselfish because I really wanted to. So then it tells us exactly how. Last paragraph on page 62, this is the how and why of it. Like, boom, here's the directions. First, we had to quit playing God. What does that mean? It means taking an action and being attached to the results. Again, I can want my kids to go to church. That's like normal. I'm not a robot, but I can't have a demand. If I have a demand, I'm playing God. And why do we have to quit playing God? Because it's disrespectful to God and all that? Probably, but they just tell us why. It doesn't work. This is a very practical program. It doesn't work. Next, we decided in this drama of life, God was going to be our director, right? I could quit playing God and, you know, make my husband into God, make, you know, a political leader or a religious leader into God. And they're like, nope, God's the director. And it tells us our role. It says, he's the principal, we're his agent. So a principal has work that needs to get done and sends his agent out to do it. So, you know, here we talk sometimes that God created the world in 6 days, took a day off to rest, and then spends the rest of his time launching search and rescue missions for addicts. If I'm his agent, I'm going to be sent on some of his search and rescue missions. What a wonderful way to redeem my selfish, self-centered past. But not only that, right? Like, I mean, I have a boss, I have a job, and, you know, I could say he's the principal and I'm his agent, right? He tells me what to do and I do it. But this goes further. They say God is the Father. And I would say and we are his children, his beloved sons and daughters. The idea of father might be hard for those of us who didn't have ideal fathers. But as we've gone through the book, we've seen already what this says about our Heavenly Father. We throw ourselves under his protection and care. You know, this is a God, this is a Father who loves us. And it says, most good ideas are simple. And this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we pass to freedom, from black and white into color. And then it tells us the third step promises, beautiful promises. It says all sorts of remarkable things happen. We have a new employer with a capital E, right? My boss here in New Jersey may be my boss, but my real employer is God. Being all powerful, he provides what we need if two conditions. We kept close to him. We pray, we meditate, talk to him throughout the day, and perform his work well. It doesn't say we get good results, right? I could try to take 20 people through the steps. And if I'm doing it with love and correct information and none of them recover, I'm still performing his work well. And it says, established on such a footing, what footing? Staying close to him and performing his work well. What happens? Here's the cool results. We become less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs, right? Our heart starts getting rewired more and more. See, recovery is progressive too, just like the illness. More and more, we become interested in seeing what we can contribute as we felt new power flow in. Remember in step two, we started to get a little bit of power. Now we got more, right? Each step gives us more power, new power, and we get peace of mind. We can relax. We discovered we could face life successfully. We're not afraid of things anymore. We become conscious of his presence. We're aware that there's God, aware, conscious of it, not just a belief, a consciousness. and we begin to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. I used to have this terrible fear that 10 minutes after I died, God was going to take out this book and look at my good deeds on one side and the bad on the other. And since the bad outweighed the good, I was in trouble. That was a fear I had, but it says we begin to lose these fears. And then we consecrate our lives to God. Consecrate means set aside for, I guess I would say, use by God. We consecrate ourselves. We offer ourselves to God to build with us and do with us whatever he wants. We ask to be relieved of the bondage of self. Why? So our lives are easy? No, so we can better do his will. I can't do his will if I'm all tangled up in myself. We ask for our difficulties to be taken away so that we can be a witness of three things: God's power, God's love, and God's way of life, that he's strong enough, that he loves me enough, and that there is a way of life that can bring us all to him. And it says, we think well before doing this. We want to make sure we're ready, that our ABCs are in place, that we could abandon ourselves utterly. And then it says what a promise that it says you may get. It says, this is only a beginning. Imagine we're getting all this already and it's just the beginning. But if we're honest and humble, in effect, sometimes a very great one is felt at once. We're consecrated. We're no longer alone. We're no longer without power. So that's what I have on step three. And next week we will pick up with, once we've turned our lives over to God, it goes right on to next. We launched out on a course of vigorous action. So we'll be talking about that next week.